The backlash continues in the wake of the US Supreme Court's removal of the constitutional right to abortion by striking down Roe v. Wade, which of course goes to the heart of women's rights. Lawyer Gloria Allred has become the face of most lately the Me Too movement in the United States. Just this week has seen the sentencing of two people, Ghislaine Maxwell and R. Kelly, whose victims she represented. She also worked with Jane Roe, real name Norma McCorvey. We spoke about her with Joshua Prager the other week. Gloria Allred worked with her in the 1980s, a decade or so after that historic Roe v. Wade decision. Gloria Allred spoke to me then at a time of both victory and setback for women.
Well, it's always challenging for women and for victims. For Roe v. Wade, it's been devastating, and women are upset and outraged and crying. And I always say, first we cry, then we fight. And there are demonstrations in the street in many, many cities across the country. And protests continue in many places. We are going to have to make sure that we vote. We have to make sure that we elect pro-choice candidates, both on the federal and state level, because essentially the Supreme Court has thrown it back to the states. And about half of the states in the United States have already implemented or soon will implement what are called trigger laws, triggered by the Supreme Court decision, and they are making it unlawful or extremely difficult to get a legal and safe abortion in about half the states in the United States. So that means what we have are potentially millions of what I call abortion refugees who are going to have to travel from states where they can't get a legal and safe abortion to states which we call sanctuary states or haven states like New York or California or some other states where they will be able to get a legal and safe abortion.
Indeed.
Of course.
I think, sorry to interrupt, I think California has a state constitution which guarantees the right to abortion, and now Governor Newsom has, with Oregon and Washington, agreed to establish a West Coast protection zone. In the other states, if the...
Well, actually, in California, yes, we are a blue state. We are a pro-choice, progressive state. We do have a law that protects a woman's right to have a legal and safe abortion. However, on the ballot in November, we are also going to now be able to vote on a constitutional amendment to our state constitution, which will guarantee a woman a right to choose abortion. I do want to say that as to women in those anti-choice, I call them the mandatory motherhood states, compulsory pregnancy states, which often don't even allow for exceptions for rape or incest victims, or even in some places, if the woman's life is endangered by the pregnancy, they won't let her get an abortion. So in some states, the women or, you know, the pregnant persons will not be able to travel even, because it does hurt the poor and the rural women and the young women and the women of color the most. They may not have funds to travel to the haven states like California. They may, even if the funds are provided to them, and California is going to do everything possible to provide funds to those in other states to be able to travel to California to get a safe and legal abortion. But some will not be able to leave their own states because they don't have money for childcare. They have other children. They may work two or three jobs. They may not be able to take time off from their jobs to travel. So this is really going to be life-changing for many women. They may also try to get an illegal abortion in their state. They may try to get a medication abortion to self-abort through a pill. But there are states who are even trying to prohibit that process for women to be able to do it themselves in the privacy of the home, their own home. This is it's just really unacceptable. It's draconian. It's cruel. And it's barbaric what these states are doing to women and girls.
As you say, in the past 4 years, 11 states, I think, have passed abortion bans that have no exceptions for rape or incest. Mm-hmm. But the issue of medical abortion, abortion pills, will they not continue to be available? They can be delivered by mail now. How can the restrictive states police that?
Because in many states, in order to get that abortion pill, they need to first have an internet, essentially telecommute consultation with a doctor, a medical doctor. And so there are licensed doctors who are willing to do that. But many states are contemplating, for example, South Dakota, interfering with that process. So if they can interfere with that medical consultation given on the internet by a doctor to the woman who wants the pill, then it may be that the woman will not be able to obtain the pill. The pill itself is safe. The Federal Food and Drug Administration has said that it's safe to take, and many have received it through the mail after the consultation on the internet with the doctor. So this is really how extreme some states are becoming and willing to go to just even try to prohibit a medication abortion. I'm glad you mentioned that, because about half of all the abortions in the United States are done through medication abortions. So if states can restrict that, it's really a problem for those women in those states.
Your personal experience, and you've spoken about this recently, you had an illegal abortion long before Roe v. Wade. What was that experience about for you?
Well, that's right. And this was in the late 1960s when I was in my 20s. And after I was raped at gunpoint in Mexico and came back to California, where I was living, and I was a teacher at the time, I wasn't a lawyer. I was also a single parent. I wanted to get an abortion after I found out that I was pregnant as a result of the rape. And I didn't know, but I soon found out that abortion was not legal for a doctor or a nurse or a licensed healthcare provider to do in California at that time. And matter of fact, it was a crime to provide it, which meant that I, like many other women at that time, and it was a crime in many other states as well, like Texas, sought a back alley abortion, that is, provided by a stranger who would do it for the money but wasn't licensed. And he did it and in someone else's apartment and then left me in a pool of blood hemorrhaging in the bathtub. When I asked him if he could help me afterwards, he said he didn't do that. He didn't take care of me afterwards. And that's, you know, and I should essentially tear up his number. So ultimately, an ambulance did take me to the hospital, and I was packed in ice because I had a 106-degree fever from the infection that he caused by the illegal abortion. And as I say in my Netflix documentary, Seeing All Red, an anti-choice nurse said to me, "Well, I hope this will teach you a lesson." And the lesson I did learn was not the one she wanted me to learn, but that abortion should be safe and legal and available and affordable to all women and girls who would want to have that as an option. Because safe and legal abortion, in many cases, is much safer than childbirth. But what's dangerous and unsafe are illegal abortions, and women will never stop having abortions. It's just in half the states, they may have to choose the dangerous option of illegal abortion because they will be desperate to get one.
if the polls are correct and that support among Americans for abortion, for choice, has never been higher. More than two-thirds of Americans wanted to retain Roe v. Wade.
You're correct.
Then in state elections, which the Supreme Court says, you know, let's go there, let the states decide, will pro-choice people not be voted in? Problem solved.
Well, the answer is we need to do that. But, for example, in the United States Senate, we need, in order to pass a federal law nationalizing, or we say codifying, Roe v. Wade, to say that there must be a national federal law requiring the right to choose legal abortion in all states, we would need not just a majority of the United States Senate. We're going to need at least 60 to pro-choice to break a filibuster. And it's unlikely we'll get 60, but we have to try and we have to vote.
You mean
same
that?
Same as true with the House of Representatives. So in other words, majority of pro-choice Democrats is not going to be enough. Right now, the Senate is 50-50.
No,
that's not enough.
But if you do it state by state, you're saying...
Now, state by state, and that is important, essential, in fact, especially in the states that are anti-choice, you know, the mandatory motherhood states. It is essential that we help, especially the women in those states, to elect pro-choice representatives and governors to their state legislatures and, you know, to the executive branch of their state government. That, because we have extreme Republicans in those anti-choice states, that is why they are able to pass laws that are contrary to the will of many of the people in their states. And they're doing it because they're the anti-choice people. They're appealing to their base. Their base in the Republican Party is mainly men. And in addition, you know, the evangelical right wing. And so what these politicians seem to care about most is getting reelected, holding on to their political power. And they're willing to do so at the expense of women and their lives. And this is why women in those states, we need to do what the famous labor organizer Mother Jones said, which is don't agonize, organize. And that's what we have to do in those states, is to help them politically at the next election.
But presumably you're saying that if it doesn't become codified in federal law, every state election, people will have to fight the same old battle.
Exactly. You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because at one of the pro-choice rallies one time, I saw a woman, an older woman, who was carrying a sign, and it said, you know, and she was pro-choice, and it said, I've been carrying the same sign for almost 50 years, and my arms are getting tired. So we're going to have to keep carrying those same damn signs probably for another at least 25 years. And we can't afford to be tired.
When did you realize, Gloria, that Roe v. Wade was over? I mean, as soon as the Supreme Court reached the majority of conservative judges, some say. Did you think that?
And of course, I'm not even calling them conservative now. I'm calling them what they are, which is extremist. Because they didn't respect the almost 50-year-old precedent of Roe v. Wade, which was affirmed in another Supreme Court case called Casey, which upheld Roe v. Wade. And even though they, you know, five of them in their Senate confirmation hearings testified about Roe v. Wade as being a precedent and it's in fact a super precedent, and they seemed to indicate that they would respect precedent, which most justices do. They didn't respect it in this case. They just threw it out. I began to be concerned when President Trump, who was very anti-choice, as a matter of political convenience to get elected, was able to nominate three anti-choice justices to the United States Supreme Court, and then they were confirmed. And three of the five who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade last week are, in fact, Trump appointees. So he fulfilled what he said he would do. He fulfilled his pledge to nominate anti-choice. They call them pro-life, but I call them anti-choice justices to the Supreme Court. When we read the leaked opinion of the Supreme Court on this issue some months ago, I developed a sense of dread that, in fact, if this would happen, and sure enough, it did happen last Friday, and it's really, you know, we are going to have to mobilize like never before. And I've always said, you know, women have never been given any rights at all, ever. We've always had to fight to win them. Nobody's given them to us. And we've always had to fight to preserve whatever rights we have. So now we're going to have to fight some more, even if our arms are getting tired, even if we're getting older, because we know what's at stake. It's women's lives that are at stake. And so we have to keep on keeping on.
It has been said that the Democrats had a chance to override the filibuster and codify Roe in May, but failed to do so. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, the vice president, formerly United States Senator from California, Kamala Harris, did an interview, and she said the votes are just not there. Even if they said, okay, let's do away with the filibuster. The filibuster could be done away with. It. There have been exceptions to it in the past. For example, to raise the debt ceiling. Well, I would think women's lives are more important than raising the debt ceiling. So, but we have this struggle. We don't have enough votes. I agree with her. We only have, you know, 50 Democratic senators. A couple of them, we're not even sure if they would vote in favor of choice and abortion. I think 48 would, two are in question. So we would need Republican senators to vote. There are not enough to make 60 to break that filibuster. But without getting into the technical, we have to keep trying and voting and mobilizing, because the bad news is the Republicans, some of them, are saying that they want people to go to the polls to elect more Republican United States senators, because they also want to pass the national law. But the national law they want to pass is to outlaw abortions in all of the states, not just the half where the states are willing to outlaw it. So that would be very drastic. And so we do have to be involved at both the federal and state levels.
Meanwhile, Roe v. Wade was about privacy of the individual, essentially. And there are those who speculate that other areas of formerly considered to be private morality, same-sex marriage, for example, will also be under threat. What do you think?
Yes, I'm very concerned about marriage equality, because I, for many years, I've represented many individuals, including my clients who wanted to marry same-sex couple but were denied a marriage license. And because we fought that case for many years, my clients became the first in Los Angeles County to be afforded the right to marry after we won at the California Supreme Court. And now Justice Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court is indicating that he might like to look at that next, because the word privacy is not in the United States Constitution, and he's suggesting that maybe that is something he would like to review, that former U.S. Supreme Court decision, which said there is a constitutional right to marry and it applies to same-sex couples. So this is very concerning, and also because he also wants to review another decision called Griswold, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1965, which said that married couples have a right to birth control, contraceptives, and of course not just limited to married couples. That is really going back. Well, we won't go back. And so, but this is the, you know, brave new world, the horrible future that we face unless we take significant action. One of the actions that is under consideration by some people is to expand the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's very controversial. I don't know that it will happen, but, you know, we're going to need to have protection for women and girls, however we do it.
Why would Clarence Thomas put contraception in his sights? What's his thinking, do you think?
You know, I don't know what his thinking is, because I think his thinking is there's no right to privacy in the United States Constitution. What? It doesn't say anything about interracial marriage, but I noticed that he didn't mention that. It's called Loving versus Virginia, United States Supreme Court case. He didn't say he wanted to review that. Maybe that's because he's in an interracial marriage. But that used to be prohibited in some states in the United States as well. But since that affects him, perhaps he's not that interested in reviewing that case.
Let me talk about Ghislaine Maxwell for a moment. You spent your career representing not only, but mostly women who have been victims of harassment, discrimination, sexual abuse. You represented victims both of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. She's just been sentenced to 20 years in prison. Is there any part of you that believes that Ghislaine Maxwell herself was a victim?
Well, I mean, that's the position of her attorneys.
That's correct.
Obviously, that's not what the prosecution alleges, and she was convicted by a jury, and she was sentenced today to 20 years, which is less than what the prosecution wanted, but more than what the defense wanted. It is what the probation department did indicate and did suggest to the judge. No doubt there'll be an appeal on her part, possibly a motion for a new trial, whatever. But, you know, it is, she's been convicted of sex trafficking of an underage girl. This is, and some other, there are other victims as well. I really can't find sympathy for her, because sex trafficking is of an underage girl is a very serious crime. And do I see her as a victim? No, I don't. And, you know, people have to pay the consequences of any crimes that they commit. So, no, I don't see her as a victim.
I understand.
I see the victims as the victims. I represent 20 victims of Jeffrey Epstein, some of whom had contact with Ms. Maxwell as well. But it's always a sad day for anyone who's sentenced to a long time in prison. But on the other hand, if they've convicted crimes, you know, then they have to pay the price of their wrongful and criminal acts.
I know. It's just, we've spent this interview talking about how the lives of women have been and are distorted by society. And I just wondered whether you could find it in your heart to think that Ghislaine Maxwell's life was also distorted beyond her control.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by distorted, but look, everybody has challenges in their life. No one is spared. Not the rich, not the powerful, not the famous, not the poor, not the middle class. We all have challenges, okay? But No, I have sympathy for the victims. I'm very proud of victims and their courage to testify in a court of law, to be vigorously cross-examined by highly paid defense attorneys, and to stand up to that and tell their truth. And victims are standing up both in the criminal justice system, also in the civil justice system. We just won a big case against Bill Cosby last week. Our firm did. Our client alleged that she was the victim of sexual battery when she was a child by Mr. Cosby at the Playboy Mansion. And we won $500,000 for her. That is, the jury awarded our client $500,000. So, you know, for a famous celebrity who sexually molests a child, no, I don't have any sympathy for him. There are others who will feel differently, but, you know, I represented 33 women at one point who accused Bill Cosby of inappropriate conduct with them. So I don't feel any sympathy for him.
I think you're about to represented more alleged victims in L.A., Harvey Weinstein's victims.
Yes, I did represent the key victim.
Yes.
Who testified in the criminal case against Mr. Weinstein.
That's Mimi Haley, yeah?
Yeah, and based on her testimony, he was convicted of criminal sexual assault and sentenced to 20 years. So I'm going to have to go in a couple of minutes, but I really appreciate your inviting me on. I visited New Zealand many, many decades ago. It's a beautiful, beautiful country. And I'm so glad that you have honored me by inviting me onto your program.
It's a pleasure. If I could just ask you one more question.
Sure.
We've been talking about Roe versus Wade. You represented Norma McCorvey. I talked to Joshua Prager, author of The Family Roe. So we know a bit about Norma McCorvey. You represented her in the 80s, did you not?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little about her?
Norma was a very complicated person. I met her when she approached me at a pro-choice rally in Washington, D.C. And she came up to me and introduced herself, and I said, oh, are you speaking at this rally? And she said, no. I said, really? Why not? It's about Roe v. Wade. And she said, well, I wasn't asked to speak. And I haven't been asked to speak at pro-choice rallies. I said, well, is that something you want to do? And she said, yes. So I helped her for the next few years to speak out in favor of choice. At some point, years later, she decided to speak out in support of, you know, the mandatory motherhood point of view, anti-choice. But at the end of her life, she made a deathbed confession on tape, essentially saying she was always pro-choice. She only went over to the anti-choice side because they paid her, and she did a good job of acting as though she was anti-choice. So that was Norma. She needed the money. I'm not there to criticize Norma McCorvey. Being a pro-choice person, I support those who make a choice to have an abortion, those who say they don't want to make a choice to have an abortion. Unfortunately, the anti-choice side does not support those who want to make a choice, unless it's the choice of not having a legal, not having an abortion. So all I can say is this has been a shocking change with the U.S. Supreme Court decision. We're just, you know, we have a saying, and Martin Luther King Jr. once said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. So we have to hang on to that, and we have to fight for justice in order to win it. And that's what I intend to continue to do for the rest of my life.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was Gloria Allred, U.S. lawyer.